Welcome to Clearly Quaker, an ongoing series of podcasts by Salem Quarterly Meeting, part of the Religious Society of Friends. Salem Quarterly Meeting is an association of seven Southern New Jersey Quaker meetings within Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. The following podcast is a lecture by Chris Densmore, curator of Friends Historical Library at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. Chris has an abiding scholarly and personal interest in historic Quaker journals and shared his knowledge with friends gathered for this series of lectures. This second lecture, given at Friends Village in Woodstown, New Jersey, focuses on early New Jersey Quakers and their relationship to slavery.
So this series is all about, it's mainly about Quaker journals, people writing about their experiences. And often there's a very sort of a structured way of beginning journals, and it goes back to George Fox and others about, you know, this is not just what I'm doing, but this is how the Lord has been dealing with me, and this is my travels and tribulations and whatever. And in many ways, the Society of Friends for years has passed on its values and what it wants to do, not so much through writing books of theology, because no one could agree on what the theology was anyway, but looking at sort of lives led in the light. And so we have sort of traditional journals like George Fox and John Woolman. If you read any Quaker journals, those are probably the ones you started with. Well, there are a whole host of other ones going back to the beginning and onto the present. There are quite a number of very interesting ones from New Jersey in the late 1700s. This actually was a very much a hot spot at that time, particularly on the abolition of slavery issue. You know, where did that whole drive come from? Well, you know, the issue of enslavement had been an issue that came up at Yearly Meeting year after year for many years. George Fox kind of addressed it and said, maybe if, you know, people are working for you, you should let them free after a while and don't let them go away empty-handed. It wasn't a full-fledged, let's end slavery right now, but it was sort of, for its time, it was, you know, amazingly progressive. But a lot of the ideas that became, so if anybody has trouble hearing, just, you know, raise your hand. My wife claims I mumble, so raise your hand or throw something at me. But, you know, getting back to Quaker journals, there are really quite a few of them that came out of New Jersey within a couple of generations. John Woolman is sort of, you know, the classic Quaker journal, particularly for his involvement with slavery, from beginning with sort of misgivings about it, and this doesn't really seem right, to a position where he's writing tracts about slavery. And it is these works, along with the works of Anthony Benezet in Philadelphia, that later will get over to England and convince the English to begin an anti-slavery movement. You know, the American anti-slavery movement is much earlier than the English, but people like Thomas Clarkson, when he writes his History of the Abolition of the Slave Trade, you know, he's starting with Woolman. And there's some more obscure people like David Cooper was in this area, some of the very earliest American writings about slavery come from here. Of course, sometimes friends don't really realize, well, gee, you know, at one point Quakers had slavery. But it's sort of hard to get your mind back to the past, because at one time, people all over the world seemed to understand that slavery was something that always existed and always had existed for all times, and all people, the Greeks did it, the Romans did it, the Egyptians did it. Everybody did it. So it's like war. You know, war may be unfortunate, but the likelihood of it disappearing entirely is some sort of hallucination. And so when those, you know, early Quakers in New Jersey, when they're, you know, they're finally saying, hey, look, you know, this system seems to have existed for all time, but maybe we can, in fact, do something to stamp it out totally. So this is one reason to read these journals. You also get into particularly people like John Hunt and Joshua Evans. They're really self-examining themselves. If you read John Woolman's first essay on the keeping of Negroes, that the theme of it is not so much a purely sort of anti-slavery, slavery is bad, but it's a meditation on self-will, about the tendency of people to want to do things to please themselves without thinking of the consequences. And what's the worst example of it? Human slavery, you know, the idea that you could so put yourself in a position you really, you were in absolute charge of what somebody else did for their time. Before we started tonight, we were sitting over there in the chairs and we were talking a bit about the records. I'm head of Friends Historical Library at Swarthmore College. We and the Quaker Collection at Haverford College are the joint, the two institutions have joint custody of the archival records of the meetings and all of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, and matter of fact, all of Baltimore Yearly Meeting. We also have New York Yearly Meeting. These records, in fact, are, if you're in a meeting and you've sent your older records to us, they're your records. So if the meeting clerk signed a letter and said, I want our minutes back, you know, here they are, they're yours. We might suggest that that's not necessarily a wise thing to do, because we've had some horror stories of some meeting that wants to do its history, and they request back their minutes, and we say, are you really sure about that? And 5 years later, we get a call from them, and they say, I need to look up something in the minutes for 1923. I said, well, you have them. No, we don't. They're nowhere in sight. And so, you know, things just kind of disappear. There was a meeting in this particular area that very carefully had everything, all the old records, or at least a big portion of the records, in a safe. Except somebody broke into that meeting house and decided, what can I steal? Oh, here's this funky old Victorian safe. Whether that person actually knew there were records in there or not is another question, but they kind of like the safe. So somewhere, hopefully, maybe they're in somebody's attic somewhere, or unless they were deep six. But there is a relationship between the sort of the Quaker practice and desire to keep minutes of meetings to sort of record what they're doing. You know, if John Woolman is looking at, or George Fox is looking at what the Lord has done with my life and my trials and my tribulations, meeting records are the same sort of thing. You know, Quakers profess certain things. Some of those professions sort of change over time. You know, in the 18th and 19th century, we talked about plainness. Now we talk about simplicity. Well, simplicity and plainness, are they really the same concepts? I, for one, am not really sure that they are. I think there's sort of a difference there. But one of the things one of the reasons you keep archives is sort of accountability of organizations. We profess to do this as friends, or the United States government professes to do something. You know, it's acting under certain guidelines. Well, this is one of the ways you're recording. Now, how are we doing? The queries that meetings often still answer, but they were very, even much more part of the meeting structure in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, that, you know, every couple of months you were considering a query like, how are we doing on this and that testimony? Are friends clear of sleeping in meeting? That was the one that was always, usually got a response mostly. course, meetings at that time could go on for a lot longer than they generally do today. So one of the things you look at those minutes, it is sort of a record of, you know, how are we doing? And sometimes they were doing fairly well, and sometimes not so well. One of the questions is our love and unity maintained among friends? All through the 1820s, everybody says, oh, yes, yes, yes. And then you have the Hicksite separation where half the meetings walk out. The Society of Friends divide. And the next month, they said, our love and unity maintained among friends. And oh, yes, yes, yes. Because, you know, somehow ignoring the fact that you just managed to have this sort of acrimonious Hicksite Orthodox separation. Well, love and unity are now well maintained because all the Orthodox walked out. We don't have to deal with them anymore. Does anybody have questions about about records and what we have at Swarthmore or Haverford? You can get a fair amount of information just by Googling Friends Historical Library and going through a number of steps, but eventually you'll get to something that says meeting records organized by yearly meeting. Then you go in and find the meeting you're looking for, and that has a list of all the records that are either at Haverford or Swarthmore, with the possible exception of things we've gotten in the last 6 months or so. But then that also gets a little confusing because meetings change names and they change structure, and until the 20th century, monthly meetings used to always be consisting of several localized meetings. So you get, I'm just going to pull something to the air, and it's probably not an exact example, but you get Piles Grove, which is what Woodstown used to be. Well, there was no Woodstown monthly meeting until, I think, the 1950s. But there was a Pile Grove preparative meeting because they prepared business to take to the monthly meeting. And so one of the other meetings in the area, you know, Salem, any the ones we could think of were the monthly meetings. And sometimes, even though it was called such and such a meeting, like in Chester County, we still have Euclid monthly meeting. At one time, there were two meeting houses, one in Downingtown and one up at Euclid. The one at Euclid has not been a Friends meeting for more than a century, but Downingtown still calls itself, we are Euclid monthly meeting. We just happen to be meeting at Downingtown. So it gets a little confusing. Quakers are sort of conservative about changing names. So you get out my way, we have Kennett monthly meeting. Well, it's actually now Kennett Square, but that actually started as Newark meeting from not Newark, Delaware, but well, actually from Newark, Delaware, but not the one you think of, one that was near Wilmington. But that meeting died out after about 20 years. And so there's no meeting in Newark at all, but there is a meeting at Center in northern Delaware called Center because it was sort of halfway between Newark near Wilmington and Kennett up on Route 1. But the monthly meeting persisted on calling itself Newark Monthly Meeting for about 30 years after there was no longer a Newark Monthly Meeting. They finally decided, let's get up with modern times, folks. Let's call ourselves Kennett, because that's in fact what we are, and that's what the local meeting was always called. A lot of the records were scanned by Ancestry a few years ago and are available online. So if you're looking for a particular person and put in their name and dates and that sort of thing, you'll be able to find a lot of things that have been put on through Ancestry. Unfortunately, Ancestry doesn't quite understand Quaker records, but it's a lot of very useful information, sometimes mislabeled. Okay, thank you. I'd like things to sort of get more into discussion. So if people have questions as we go along, the meeting records give you only so much information. For example, if somebody's disowned for horse racing or some crime, what you'll get in the monthly meeting records is the overseers or the preparative meeting brought the attention of the monthly meeting that friend so-and-so is doing less and such, and the meeting sends out a committee, and the committee comes back and said, we have further labor to do, and they go back, and it's back and forth and back and forth, and finally they, the poor guy gets tossed out, which of course always includes something that says, we hope that you are going to improve your behavior and stop doing these things that you're doing and return to membership, which a lot of people, in fact, did, particularly people that married out. You weren't supposed to do that, but then after 5 years, the people saw, they're still attending meeting. Their kids are attending meeting. They look like Quakers. They talk like Quakers. They didn't do that right, so, you did that wrong. I'm not going to do that again. So there we go. But a lot of times, the information is so sparse, you sort of wish they tell you, what are all the juicy details in this? What are all the, what's all the information? Which is why it's so important to get into things like journals with friends. How did it actually feel to be part of this Quaker world? The John Hunt Journal is marvelous. It's been sitting in Friends Historical Library. Parts of it has been sitting there since the early 1930s. At some point, the family apparently just divided up this whole long journal into three parts. And one part stayed in New Jersey, one part may have gone to Ohio, and another part also stayed in New Jersey, but a different part of the family. We've recovered two-thirds of it. And even though it's only two-thirds, the text we have is 1,000 single-spaced pages. That's a lot of time. He kept the journal from 1770 to 1824. A lot of people keep journals, but John Woolman, for example, is keeping a journal, but he's not telling you what he does every day. He's just telling you about, I'm going up to Easton to see the Indians, or I'm going to decide whether I want to buy a undyed hat. All these kinds of things. I think there's only one reference to the fact he actually has a family. not very often. John Hunt, in fact, records what he does every day. And so you can start off in the journal. In 1870, he is 30 years old, and he's a farmer, but he's also a wood turner. He makes shoes. He does what farmers did at that time. You can turn your attention to almost any kind of a craft. And so his sideline was making pumps. And so many of the entries are, finish the pump for, Ebenezer Busby. And it's 18 feet long and settled up. And there you go. Just the kind of detail that probably doesn't get into a lot of published journals because it's so very repetitive. But one of the things to remind you is, people had lives. Somebody was, there was a structure sort of supporting what people were doing. And then Hunt gets more and more convinced that he should speak in meeting, which of course, and some people seem to do it with, I'm going to speak in meeting. And for other people, it may have been years of turmoil. And you can see Hunt, particularly in his early years, did I go too far? Did I, was this really edifying? Am I making a fool out of myself, sort of thing? Very interested in this. And of course, this gets into an issue today among certain friends is, what is meeting for worship all about? What's speaking in meeting for worship? what does it mean? Should we have elders or now ministry and council be sitting up there in the facing benches and ready to sort of elder, though that's the wrong term, people if they're speaking inappropriately? There's some very interesting New Jersey parts of the journal. Garcia's, like a lot of friends of that time, particularly after he's acknowledged in the ministry, which would be at Evesham meeting, he's almost constantly traveling around. He's going to quarterly meeting, he's going to this meeting, he's going to that meeting. He's on a committee for the Reformation of Friends and trying to get Friends to be more strict about their dress and conduct. He's on committee to visit those Friends who have not yet freed their slaves, and he's traveling around. He visits people in hospitals, in prisons. That gets tacked onto it. Then later in life, the work of religion in his life does diminish, but as he gets older, he seems to have more time to read books. And so he'll read a book, and then he'll give a long description of the bad treatment of French Protestants during the St. Bartholomew massacre in France. So he's really coming to look at things. Another sort of interesting thing is, like a lot of Friends of that era, he is very, very familiar with the Bible. And so much so that a lot of what he's actually saying are references or paraphrases to the scripture. The scriptures actually are a very nice place of finding, good ways to say something. Stories and kind of things that people connect to. So as part of this project, I've had students going through and transcribing the diary from the early handwriting. And most people get scared of this at first, but actually most reasonably intelligent people can look at the old handwriting, and if you spend a day with it, you pretty much know how to do it. It doesn't mean you know how to read every letter, but that's what he's saying. But I also had them try to track down references. If he's quoting something from literature, as he's got a poem here, well, who's it by? Where is he getting this information? Or he's quoting this thing or that thing. Where is it coming from? And it's fortunate today we have this wonderful, all this stuff that's online, including the King James Version of the Bible in various versions, which seems to be the one that he's using. So you think, oh yeah, he looks like he's quoting scripture, and so you click it in and say, oh yeah, that's from such and such a verse. So another thing you can get for it is, what's he quoting? Actually, I'm very surprised because he has very little New Testament material in there. It's mostly the Old Testament. It's sort of the apocalyptic literature, like the Book of Daniel. It's Psalms. It's Proverbs. Rarely Leviticus. But you can sort of get an idea of his sort of sensibility from how he's looking at Scripture. Okay. It's like going into somebody's house. For certain of us, it's like the first thing you kind of look at is what's on the bookshelf. Because you can tell a lot about people from what's on their bookshelf, including the ones that have only put things on the bookshelf because they know you're looking at them, but have probably never read them. But on the other hand, it's like, you and I probably went to college at the same year because you have the books that were very, popular at that time. And in a way, Quakers are like other sort of sectarian groups. There's often this little dance people do to sort of figure out whether somebody else is a Quaker. Like, you know, you don't know it, but there's something about them. It's like, wait a minute, they wear sensible shoes. You know, what's that all about? I mean, this is where you get into, you know, plainness versus simplicity. You know, I maintain Quakers have never lost the plain dress. It's just that it's no longer plain in the sense of the Anabaptists, where it's a specific looking, but most Quakers, in fact, dress plain. You don't, I don't see a lot of gold jewelry, you know, flashing back at me from you folks. Mm-hmm. You know, big bouffant here, you know, all these kind of things. I mean, you know, maybe you did it for prom or something like that, but other than that, it's pretty straightforward. I was sitting in Birmingham meeting one day, and some young couple comes in, and the man sits down next to me, and he has a gold watch hanging out of his, you know, wristwatch hanging out of his arm, and his wife has got, you know, this heavy ornate gold jewelry that looks like, no, that's not gold colored, that is gold. And it's like, is he lost? Which also gets into the question about how inviting meetings are to various people, because when people come in that are sort of don't fit the mold that a meeting may have be very comfortable in. You know, looking at somebody and having the first thing to think is like, you don't belong here. It's like, no, that's not a good way. That's not a good way of thinking. But it's there. A couple of the in the handout that was passed out on the sort of the inaugural address, I had some sections about John Hunt and the Revolutionary War and how it's impacting him. And I also had some sections on Native Americans. You know, this is New Jersey. This is the 1770s, 1780s, 1790s. And there are still members of the Lenape Indians living in New Jersey. Actually, there's still a few Lenape living in New Jersey today as we speak. Yes.
In fact, Salem Quarter has an Indian committee that is very much involved in working with the local Lenape Indians still.
Yeah. If you want to go to a good conference on the topic, in the second weekend of November, there's a conference on Quakers, First Nations, and American Indians in Philadelphia, which is going to be free, but you can hear all kinds of discussions, including people who are sort of approaching things from a very academic point of view, including Gene Soderlund, who's an excellent Quaker historian, but her last book was on the Indians who lived in New Jersey prior to the arrival of European Americans. So it's very good. And she has some interesting outlook also, though it's not part of her present book, on what's happening in New Jersey from the arrival of Quakers in the next century or so. And not exactly a spoiler alert, you know, some Native Americans just kind of integrate into the local population. You know, they're the ancestors of modern New Jerseyans. You know, they begin dressing like European Americans, farming like European Americans, intermarrying with European Americans. It's just, you know, that was one way of doing things. But others maintain their own communities, and by the time of Hunt and Evans are fairly impoverished. Hunt keeps talking about a place called Edgepillock, or something of that nature. I've never heard anybody say it, but that was where the Indians were living. And so he and Joshua Evans are you know, going up there. It's not all that far from Evesham and Mount Holly. But among other things they're thinking about is, you know, are we just giving people blankets, or are we giving them, you know, selling people blankets on a very, very liberal terms? You know, that whole problem of, you know, charity. you know, giving versus something where there's sort of a mutual relationship. This was very much Quaker practice during Reconstruction after the Civil War. They were building churches building schoolhouses all over the South. At one point, very, very surprised to learn that in 1870, there were substantially more schools for the newly freed slaves than there were for white people in North Carolina. But when a lot of the schools were done, it wasn't just, hey, we're gonna drop down like a drone from Philadelphia and just solve all your problems. But it's like, oh, we're gonna build a school. Like, how can you help us build a school? You know, if you can show up with a dime from your wages to help build a school, or if you could work on Saturday afternoon and help build a school. So that's when Quakers, not intending to be permanent residents of the hinterlands of North Carolina, could say, okay, now it's your school, you know, we're going away. And they could look at the school, yes, that's our school, you know, that, you know, I cut the timbers for the walls, me and my children, we came and dug the trenches for the footers in the school, and we saved money from our jobs, and we purchased these school books. So it's a very interesting thing. One of the things that happens to the Lenape in New Jersey is the Haudenosaunee, otherwise known as the Iroquois Confederacy or the Six Nations in New York State. Very powerful until they unfortunately chose the wrong side during the Revolution and their power gets smashed to a considerable amount. But the if you go across New York State, furthest east were the Mohawk, the Keep of the Western Door, the Oneida, the Onondaga, the Cayuga, Tuscarora, and then when you get to Western New York, the Senecas. And Quakers had long-term relationships with these tribes and still do in some instances. But one of the groups, the Oneida, you know, they had their land, and really this was their land. You know, the Indian land in New York State is not land that was given to the Indians in any sense. This is land that they reserved from land that they had clear title to. So they're still on land that they've always owned and always had sovereignty on, which is not necessarily the same legal state as Indians, you know, past the Mississippi or most other groups. But anyway, the Oneida put out an invitation for Native Americans in the East to come, you know, live with us, you know, you're our Indian brothers. And so two communities live side by side with the Oneida Indians. One's the Stockbridge in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, a wonderful little town. Jonathan Edwards used to be the minister there. These were the remnants of actually a number of different groups that had lived in New England, and by the time of the American Revolution, there just weren't a whole lot of them. And so some of them move up to live with the Oneida and become the Stockbridge Nation of Indians, which is actually what the main group of them had been called before. And then also, Lenape, mostly from New Jersey, move up to live next door to the Oneida. And the village down here already was sometimes referred to as Brotherton, you know, brother town, because it was sort of a place of refuge for people. The Brothertons were primarily the Lenape, but then Lenape is divided into several language groups. Lenape in southern New Jersey language is not necessarily the same as northern New Jersey and southern New York. And so this is their place of refuge. One of the things we're doing at Friends Historical Library now is there are a lot of unpublished journals of friends that went up to visit with the Indians in upstate New York and elsewhere. And in some cases, these were just visits. It's like, how are you doing? You know, what's going on? In other cases, they were negotiation of, you know, we think you people really need to learn how to use oxen to plow and plows, because you got a problem because your access to food and also to goods that you could sell diminished greatly because basically the Iroquois lost the revolution. And so you want to be able to be productive so you can feed your own people and maybe have some surplus you can take to the town and sell it in the store and get those other things that you can't produce on the reservation. So this made some very interesting conversations. And in some cases, in some ways they're one-sided conversations because the Indians that they're dealing with this time are rarely literate in English beyond being able to say a few words. You know, it's not until the 1840s when you actually get Seneca Indians that can't hold a conversation in English because a few of them go to Dartmouth and other places like this. But then eventually the Brotherton and the Stockbridge will move further west into Indiana. Then they end up in Wisconsin, and that's where the Brotherton Stockbridge reservation is. And people at Stockbridge are very interested in some of the stuff we're putting together of Quaker accounts, because they look at something that's talking about, oh, has, you know, Quinby, that's, wait a minute, that's my name. Hendricks, yeah. And we know about Hendricks, but they don't necessarily have any kind of written documentation of that for a long, long time. But actually one of the interesting things about the Stockbridge is in the 1790s, Quakers brought a few of them young women down to learn in Quaker homes the mysteries of weaving and different kind of domestic arts and that sort of thing. But also, you know, English and mathematics and things like that. So it turns out that the first school teacher in Wisconsin, the territory of Wisconsin, is a Stockbridge woman by the name of Quinby, who was educated by Quakers, supposedly on Long Island, though I've never been able to really document that sort of thing. And not only was she the first school teacher in Wisconsin, her school had both Indian and Euro-American students in it. So you get these little connections that keep going through. The one-page handout, actually it's a double-sided handout, is the first handout has a whole long section about Joshua Evans and John Hunt visiting Indians down here. Well, here's an account of Joshua Evans, who's been traveling the ministry. He's gone all the way up to Canada, and eventually he'll go down to the Carolinas. He's all over the place, but he stops and visits people, a number of whom were people he knew, but now they're up in upstate New York. They go there now. There's still an Oneida reservation, but it's basically Turning Stone Casino. And there's a lot of discussion back and forth among Native Americans about the wisdom of casinos and who actually gets money from casinos. But you can, in fact, go up there. And if you also travel around, you'll see signs along Route 20, you know, no Indian treaty. Basically, the Cayuga are trying to retain some of the land that was taken from them by doubtful means. And so, but you think of it, some of the people living on those lands have been on those lands for 215 years. So, wait a minute, you're telling me that, you know, this land that my father and grandfather and great-great-grandfather and all them owe them a farm for all these years is not my land. You know, it gets into some sort of sticky questions. Questions. I keep trying to encourage people to come up with ideas. Yes?
Is there anything distinctive about Quaker journals or journaling versus, say, the early Methodists?
Well, the early Methodists, you know, they have more structure. The among Quakers, being an acknowledged minister was just sort of a status. You've been speaking in a meeting. We think that you're speaking in the right way. We say you're a minister. But that doesn't give you any particular responsibilities. You know, you're not expected to come to meeting next Sunday with your, you know, 45-minute sermon and your four hymn selections and the doxology and all that sort of stuff. It's very different. So Methodists are doing that. But there also are similarities. And the Methodists keep talking about their quarterly meetings. Some of the early structure of the Methodist Church in this country, I do not know for a fact, but it seems logical that some of that structure was borrowed from Quakers, because this is sort of a way to hold things together when you don't have a big hierarchy and telling you what to do. You know, there's different theological approaches. But probably a better contrast is John Bunyan, the author of Pilgrim's Progress, one of my favorite books. How many people have read Pilgrim's Progress? Oh, darn. If you read it, you'll find out where a lot of our expressions come from, mudrakers and Vanity Fair. That's all from Pilgrim's Progress. But John Bunyan was a contemporary of George Fox, a Baptist, and this is before the modern Baptists arise on the scene. When we think of Baptists, mostly we think about the denomination that kind of arises in the 1780s and onward, as opposed to what Roger Williams and John Bunyan were. John Bunyan's autobiography is called Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. Like, isn't it marvelous? You know, God has saved me. I should be going to hell and burning in the fires. Which is very different from George Fox, who actually believes it's possible for people to be attentive, you know, to the workings of the Spirit and to behave in a godly fashion. So, but Fox is not going to fess up to being a great sinner. If you're a great sinner, well, stop it. You know, for some of the evangelicals, and even today, if you pick the ones that appear on television and keep throwing Bible proofs at you, it's sort of like, it doesn't matter what you do, it's just that you, you know, give your entire allegiance to Christ, but behavior doesn't matter. You know, Quakers and the Anabaptists and other groups like that, behavior very much does matter. This gets in some sort of religious pop sociology, but you know, what defines you as a friend? You know, why for people here, I suspect most people here identify with friends, so what marks out a friend is being somehow different than a Baptist or a Methodist. Now, if I was doing this in the First Church of the Gospel, people would all be raising their hands and saying, yes, you know, I've come to the anxious bench and I've given my soul to the Lord and I've been saved. But, you know, it's like you're all, it seems like, kind of reaching for that definition. There's a story about an English, which is what the Amish call us, we're English. doesn't matter whether you're Japanese, you're still English, because as opposed to them, they were plain. But so this English guy is talking to a plain person out in Lancaster County, and they're talking about this thing and that thing and farming and just all kinds of great stuff. And finally the guy says, well, you know, what's really been bothering me, and I don't know the answer to, is, are you a Christian? And the Amish guy looked at him and said, don't ask me that question, ask my neighbor. Because I'm a Christian, you know, it's shown in my life. You know, are you in fact a follower of Christ and all that it means? You know, mortification of the world, nonconformance to the world, peace, all that sort of thing. And you'll see, you know, particularly among the Mennonite communities, the further groups get away from defining themselves by behavior and defining themselves by theology, what gets lost are some of these testimonies. And you'll start to see Mennonites that are wearing plaids or colors that aren't out of the indigo scale and that sort of thing, and they will be more theological evangelical, but they're dropping this very structured approach to life. You know, you can continue this like all churches, you know, liturgical churches, you know, what makes you a Catholic? Well, you know, I receive the sacraments. You know, it's...
Well, one thing I feel is that Quakers tend not to speak for other Quakers. And so therefore, we are not offering up a specific definition that fits everybody because it may only fit me. My definition may be different from somebody else's, and that's fine.
Other folks? And I think one of the tensions in Quakerism has always been between Genesee Yearly Meeting 1842, it's just separated off from New York Yearly Meeting because New York Yearly Meeting is getting much too large and too transcendent, but they're sort of looking at their discipline, and up comes Priscilla Cadwallader. We have any Cadwalladers here? Other side in Delaware.
Up
the right, yeah. Good Welsh name, last true prince of Wales. You know, the once and future king, Cadwallader. Anyway, someday, well, never mind. Anyway, so Cadwallader is one of these very prophetic Quakers. You know, she gets up at the Farmington Meeting House in like 1832 and, oh Carolina, I hear the cannons roar, I see the blood, which she explains as having to do with slavery. That, you know, does this nation, does not clear itself of the sins of slavery, we're going to get involved in this huge, bloody Civil War. Of course, 30 years later, it happens. But she's up there, and her basic concern is not to inhibit the spiritual growth of people. You know, don't, when you're revising discipline, make sure that, you know, you're not trampling on, you know, the tender shoots that are coming up. John Comley, this one right across the river here, also a Hicksite friend, but he's very, very clear that, you know, friends need nurture. You know, it's sort of a parental relationship because, you know, if you don't have, you know, those elders and ministers there telling you the way people are supposed to do things, you're going to fall into error. But there's sort of two sides. In some ways, there are two sides. And, you know, this is me. This is not actually legitimate sociology. But I think, you know, if you look at meetings or different groups, there are people that do those functions, you know, the ones that are sort of way out there and prophetic, and the ones that are more interested in structure and stability. And a Orthodox friend from upstate New York described upstate New York Quakers in a letter to her sister back in England. This was in the 1890s, and she was living around Scipio. Well, there was an Otisite conservative branch of Scipio. There was a Kingite conservative branch of Scipio. There were Hicksites. There were Orthodox. There were Gurneyites, and there were Progressives. So it's all divided. But she was only interested in the, you know, the sort of the major split there was the Orthodox versus the Wilburites. And she writes to her sisters tonight, you know, about the Wilburites, you know, they're basically after admitting that the Hicksites and Orthodox and Gurneyites all read the same books and they looked the same. And of course, she thought that the Hicksites are much more prosperous than the Orthodox, which is very funny because almost anybody that nobody claims that we're the rich people. Everybody claims that we're the poor people. You know, you're the rich snobs. So whether or not she's true about that area. But she uses the phrase, and she was a woman that was actually involved in the revival movements when it hits New York Yearly Meeting. You know, 1870, New York out in some places having revival meetings, you know, preachers up there one after the other, and the anxious bench, and, you know, people getting happy and getting religion, you know, the whole, think revival is Ten Show, and that's what you got. She was part of that. But later in her life, they're working on a memorial to a friend that has died in Scipio, and there's a phrase in the memorial about, he never knew the hour of his salvation. Which, in other words, like Quakers, sometimes is described as growing in holiness. You know, it's not like, you know, there's your moment. Like, I was this, now I'm that, and it's all changed. No, it's for a lot of people, it's sort of a slow growth. You know, I used to be worse, but maybe a little better now, and maybe I'll get a little better, a little baby later on. But she uses the picture of, I'm sorry that the Wilburites left us because we could have used more ballast and less sail. Which sort of describes it, you know. If you're doing a boat and you're just paying attention to one side of it, you might capsize. That's another. But one of the things with journals, it's very interesting, you know, you take a look at some of these against other examples. It's not precisely a journal, though it's done in that fashion, but John Bunyan, the Baptist, Pilgrim's Progress, you know, Vanity Fair, and all those kinds of things. You know, Pilgrim is just in a similitude of a dream, and just going through, and this is the whole story of salvation. And eventually he gets to the river, and his pack falls off, which is his sins, and he crosses over the river, which is death, into the celestial city where there's gold on the streets and spires and those kinds of things. You know, it's, yeah, he made it. He's happy. He's in heaven, you know. Stephen Crisp, who was a Quaker, wrote a fairly direct takeoff on that called A Short History of a Long Travel from Babylon to Bethel. Does everybody know what Bethel means? El is the Hebrew ending on names like Michael, Gerald. El is God, Elohim. Beth is house, house of God. So that's why there's so many synagogues are named, you know, Bethel. That's where we are. And it shows up, you know, the Siemens Bethel in New York, in the old New York Harbor, that that sort of thing. But anyway, so, but his story, just like Pilgrim's story, is the Pilgrim character here goes through different groups, and he runs into people that are obviously meant to be the Anglicans and the Baptists, and every time he's with these people, he sort of eventually gets the idea, you know, it's not quite right. You know, this building I'm in has too much dust in the corners, and people don't seem to be looking at things, and I'm not fine. And so what does he get to in the end? His celestial city is a building made of glass where everybody can talk to each other. You know, just light, luminescence, you know, we can, and you know, the old people can talk to the young, and the young people can talk to the old. It's just a very different kind of vision of what the pearly gates look like. And in some ways, Chris was very interesting because this is, you know, it's heaven, but it's still places.
Thank you for listening to Clearly Quaker. We hope you have found this podcast thought-provoking. If you have questions or comments, or would like to learn more about South Jersey Quakers, reach us at salemquarter.net.